physical characteristic and talent apiece. In this case, Tish, good at games, unnaturally thick legs. Sue, good at music, wore glasses. Mara, Greek, good at supplying office equipment for the new Juniper House magazine. And Sally Elf Elphinstone, fat, good at making up a quintet. In time to solve the mystery of who has stolen Rebecca's poem, passed it off as her own. Rebecca, in case you were wondering, was tall and blonde and good at tennis and writing poetry. She got double helpings of everything because she was the main character, you see. The Trebizond series also had, brace yourselves please, boys in it. The fourth book in the series is actually called Boy Trouble at Trebizond. Rebecca starts going out with Tish's brother Robbie. I know. Martha, bring me my digitalis. In real life, these are the 12 to 14 years, my classmates were discovering real boys. I thought I was doing quite well to have discovered them in books. Had I looked like one of the Wakefield twins, I might perhaps have followed Sally's lead and got interested in dating. But the mirror and my family and friends' ongoing refusal to palter with the truth militated against this. The very vocal consensus was that, while I might end up passable eventually, between the braces, the glasses, the grease, the blackheads, and a 7-stone frame that made me look more like a drowned chick than anything human, let alone nubile, I should, for the foreseeable future, keep very much to my books. I look back on the few photographs that were taken during this period and think, yeah, fair enough. You will probably not be surprised to learn that I didn't really have a proper teenage rebellion. I looked around at everyone else's, the goths, the slags, the booze, fag and drug experimenters, the tantrum throwers, the weepers, and it seemed like a lot of work. So I remained outwardly composed and compliant, but inwardly I like to think I was as miserable as the best of them. I kept my unhappiness about never fitting in, about not having more than one friend, excellent though she was, and about looking like someone's discarded parasitic twin, to myself. Being apparently unbothered by everything only made me more of an outcast, but I just didn't know how to join in. As the clamour and frenzy of others' angst gathered ever more thickly and cacophonously around me, I felt like Ernest Thesiger, the Edwardian actor who, when asked about his experiences at the front during the First World War, cried, "My dear, the noise, the people." Then, a break in the clouds. We all, overnight or so it seemed, discovered Judy Blume. I don't know how it happened. Maybe Mrs. Heathfield got a memo from the Department of Health saying, "It is time," and unlocked a secret cupboard full of her works, and our hormones drew us towards them in a kind of reverse Bisto sniff, but suddenly she was everywhere. Judy Blume was the second and last book craze ever to hit school, the last author to unite bookworms and normals in common reading purpose. In her books was everything that Sweet Valley High left out: reality, mess, humanity and wit. To have another shared passion was brilliant. It gave us all, even me, especially me, something to talk about, to enthuse about, and the break from self-imposed cynicism and relentless manufacture of scorn was in itself a joy. But the sensation of gaining a friend and mentor in Blume herself, someone older and wiser and yet still so completely understanding, with such perfect recollection of the grotesque, tumultuous time of adolescence, of its bravura and its awful vulnerabilities, was so, so much better. It's hard to remember which one of Judy Blume's books I read first. They were all consumed so quickly and have been part of me for so long. But I think, and the publication dates of my battered collection suggest, that it was Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. All together now. We must increase our bust. I don't know whether to curse La Blume for giving me false hope, or gratefully acknowledge the fact that, false or not, it was frequently only the faintly flickering hope that a bosom and assorted other physical accoutrement might one day arrive that kept me hacking on through the fetid swamp of adolescence. "We must," was the rallying cry of Margaret, Nancy and the rest of the teenage coterie with whom Margaret becomes involved when she moves house, and encapsulated the fervent desire of every pubescent reader to be able to do something, anything, to hurry along the dreaded and longed-for day when the long-promised changes would start to arrive. Menstruation, first bras, masturbation, self-regard, self-loathing, hormonal mood swings, slut-shaming. There wasn't a name for it yet, but the practice itself was alive, well, and here aimed at poor, overdeveloped Laura Danker in her swollen sweaters. And all the hideous, fabulous rest of it are here in Blume's first foray into a part of the children's literary landscape she would make her own during the 1970s and 80s. Her insistence on writing about these things has made her a controversial figure for much of her career, especially in her native America, where she was the subject of an organized book banning campaign in the 1980s, after Reagan's election, and remains one of the country's most frequently challenged authors of the 21st century. Truly the world is frightened of those who would speak truth unto teenage girls. Though maybe it's broader than that. Maybe it's anyone who wants to speak truth to children. Catherine Patterson's Bridge to Terabithia, for example, is still number 28 on the list of 100 most frequently challenged books published every decade by the American Library Association, presumably because it deals with the subject of death and so prompts adults to consider the perennial question of how much reality children can bear. When the answer is felt to be not very much, a book tends to become officially controversial and makes it onto lists like this. But the question is really, how much reality can we bear to let our children bear? On the one hand, children are inadvertently quite good at protecting themselves. By and large, when reading, the things they aren't ready for simply go over their heads or flit lightly across their minds, leaving a faint impression that can be deepened and shaded later by experience or exposure to other books or films or TV or internet as the years go on. On the other, this is a hard thing for a parent to trust in, running as it does counter to every primitive instinct in us that wants to keep our children safe from all possible harm. Lead-lined bunkers instead of Roald Dahl, remember? But of course we can and we must. Otherwise, well, you only have to look at the rest of the ALA's list to see what madness can unfold. In the Night Kitchen is there at number 24. Naked bottoms in crazy dreamscapes are apparently worse than child mortality. Eric Carle's Draw Me a Star is at number 61. Did atheist parents object to the picture book's parallels with the Bible's creation story, or did a cross-denominational group balk at the human figures having no clothes on? It is truly impossible to imagine what objections were lodged to bring Iona and Peter Opie's I Saw Esau, a book of traditional children's rhymes, in at number 98. Is Donkey Walks on Four Legs and I Walk on Two, the last one I saw was very like you, enough to give anyone the vapours? The last edition published did have illustrations by Sendak, so maybe that's enough. But back to Bloom. I raced through everything else she had written for my age group, Deanie, Blubber, Tiger Eyes. I only managed that once. The death of a parent was something I was not willing to contemplate for too long. I'm still not. Then again, maybe I won't. A kind of Are You There, God, from a boy's point of view. Starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, which I somehow forgot to take on holiday with me to Preston when it had me most firmly in its grip. I spent the fortnight in a fever of yearning to get back to its 10-year-old vivacious heroine, her aunt's borscht, and Sally's equally vivid imaginings about being Esther Williams and of unmasking Hitler, who she suspects is one of her neighbours hiding in plain sight after the war. And, oh gosh, there's one other. What was the name of that again? Oh yes, Forever. Certain books had done the rounds over the previous year or so with their rude bits marked for quick perusal. Various Jilly Coopers, Shirley Conran's Lace, Judith Krantz's Scruples and so on. But the rudest of them all was Forever. And this time we all read every word. The story of Catherine, Michael and Ralph is engraved on every adolescent heart that has beaten since it was first published in, well, guess, you won't believe this. I didn't, because we all think we were the first to discover it, just as every generation thinks it's the first to discover sex, and that therefore she must have written it 3 months maximum before we found it. But Forever was first published in 1975. Bloom wrote it after her daughter Randy bemoaned the fact that she couldn't find a book about two kids having sex in which the girl didn't have to be punished with an unwanted child, an abortion, or by being sent away from the boy to stay with relatives in one of the less fun states, or death. Afterwards, and its depiction of mutually desired, ugly consequence-free sex remains, over 40 years on, still surprisingly rare. It's the book I always want to press into the hands of any teenage girl I see engrossed in the Twilight saga. For the uninitiated, Twilight is the first in a series of four books by Stephanie Meyer about 17-year-old Bella Swan, who falls in love with Edward Cullen, who turns out to be a vampire. He has renounced the drinking of human blood, but the hunger remains. Thus they can never have sex, because who knows what urges might be released in the throes of passion, and he fears that he might end up killing Bella instead of making sweet, sweet love to her. Over the course of the book, or books, Bella becomes more and more passive, training herself not to respond to his kisses. When she does respond, he draws away and berates her for endangering herself, gradually isolating herself from her friends and family in order to protect his secret, and generally learning to subordinate her every impulse and desire to the need not to upset Edward and his instincts. You don't have to squint too hard to see dubious parallels between this and the real-life dynamic of abusive relationships. Meyer is a practicing Mormon who generally argues that her books are about learning to master your nature, and fans defend her take on romance as the erotics of abstinence. To me, the whole thing reads badly. In every sense, Meyer is no great stylist, and feels toxic, anti-feminist and regressive, and should be staked through its black, black heart. In love with a 100-year-old vampire Bella may be, but Buffy she ain't. Nor is she Catherine, who in Forever not only has and enjoys sex without regrets, but also doesn't marry Michael. By the end, she's even survived the sadness of breaking up and has moved on. And Edward Cullen? You may have a sparkly face and great abs, but you are no Michael. Or indeed Ralph. Ralph was the name Michael gave to his penis, and Ralph really was entirely positive about people responding to his interest. This is how things should be. A few years ago, I interviewed Judy Blume at an event in Waterstones, Piccadilly. The place was packed with 30-something women who listened intently to the tiny, fragile-looking 76-year-old woman talking about her 40-odd years writing for adolescents, the fight she'd had and continues to have with censors, though nowadays less on her own behalf than on others, and her memories of writing the various books that people had clutched to their chests. By the end of the interview, it was just a room full of tearful women queuing to have their books signed and trying to find the words to tell Blume just what she'd meant to them for so many years, how it felt to see their stories in print being depicted with truth and compassion without condescension. I didn't manage it myself. I couldn't afford to. The only time we had to chat was before the interview, and I couldn't risk reducing myself to a puddle of gratitude and emotion. But I did ask if I could be cheeky and get her to sign beforehand not one but two books, Are You There, God? And starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. Because, I explained, they had both at different points meant everything to me. I couldn't choose between them and, yes, I actually said this, I didn't want one to feel left out. She understood completely. She always understood completely. When the first bloom of Blume was over for me, I filled the void with Puffin Plus books. If you are slightly older than me and remember the Puffin Peacocks books, well, this is what that series evolved into. Whereas Peacocks had gone quite heavy on the historical fiction, Puffin Plus was a bit more progressive, a bit cooler. But like Blume, they were precursors to what is today known as YA, young adult fiction, and as nearly young adult persons, Sally and I lapped them up. Some, like The Best Little Girl in the World, about a girl with an eating disorder, written by an American psychologist who specialized in treating, but not, I must sadly note on rereading, in writing terribly well about, eating disorders, were issue books, to be read with interest but rarely good enough to be loved. Some were passed around like the Jilly Coopers had been, for their rude bits. One had a blowjob scene, but in recognition of how little interested we were in the not rude bits of rude books, I cannot remember the title. It may have been I'm Kissing as Fast as I Can. It rings a bell and sounds plausible. And one, just one, was funny. That one was June Oldham's comic teen romance novel, Grow Up Cupid. It was easily the funniest book I'd read since Private Keep Out. We are introduced to the lead character, 17-year-old Margaret Dermot, Mog to her friends, thus. Ever since the day Margaret had been observed in the infant's playground lifting her dress and showing her knickers to a circle of uninterested boys, Mrs. Dermot had feared for her daughter's morals. The subsequent 12 years spent in tremulous vigilance had done nothing to relieve her anxiety. I laughed till I cried. Mog, when we meet her a few pages later, has, to the only cautious relief of her mother, dumped her boyfriend Keith for spending too much time writing poems to her and sworn off men. Instead, she throws herself into a variety of more rewarding pursuits, including recruiting students for a writer's after-hours class and gently terrorizing the college head, old enough to have lost as hostages to the years much of his cerebral hair and an athletic figure. That is how he referred to what others called bald and fat. Into organizing a creche. She also starts writing a Mills and Boone novel to earn some cash. One cannot write a book requiring a convincing representation of the perfect man without at least a modicum of research, of course. And so Mog does a spot of fieldwork with one of the fathers from the creche, Dennis from the writing class, a quick but ultimately unsatisfactory retry with Keith, before finally taking a run at punk-haired fellow student Bish. His mother had a crush on Shelley, who, though a Mills and Boone heroine might faint at the very sight of him, proves to be the perfect man for Mog. At 14, I loved the book for being funny. Now, although there is still something to make me laugh on every page, I love it even more for having such a bright, inquiring, active, charming heroine full of life, anarchy and sarcasm, a perfect rendition of the true teenage spirit. The capturing of that spirit, and of teenage humour, without which we would surely none of us have made it past 15, is still rare, at least for the upper age range of YA readers at which Mog and Puffin Plus were aimed. Slightly younger readers have these days the likes of the late great Louise Renison, whose heroines are full to the brim with a zest for life and one-liners. And whenever I'm feeling down, I reach for any of Holly Smale's Geek Girl series about oddball Harriet Manners, fact collector and regurgitator extraordinaire, who nonplusses everyone around her, especially when she manages to fall backwards, almost literally, into a modelling career. All six books and miracles are perfectly pitched and maintain tone. Harriet is so idiosyncratic and naive she could easily become frustrating and unreal, but the whole is so funny and engaging she never falls off the tightrope, and leave me with a daft smile on my face for hours afterwards. But comic fare for older teens seems thin on the ground still. Summer of My German Soldier. I was buying most of my books for myself now. It wasn't like I had a social life making any demands on my purse, and Dad had to start saving for a pension at some point. But he would still occasionally bring me a surprise present. One of them was Summer of My German Soldier by Betty Green. This dense, beautiful, astonishing, intricate portrayal of love, friendship, hatred, prejudice, and sacrifice packs so much pain, beauty, and wisdom into its compass that when I reread it now, I have to put it down every few pages and walk around for a bit to let it all bed down before I'm ready for the next chapter. There's a whole cadre of books, especially from the 1970s, that attempted to show the inhumanity of war from all sides and show the grey areas within it rather than deal simply in goodies and baddies. But never was it better done than in Green's debut novel about Patty Bergen, a 12-year-old Jewish girl living in the deep south of America. Her family is barely tolerated by their neighbours, and she is barely tolerated by her family. Her mother finds her constantly wanting, in femininity and social graces and all the other things that would make her worthy of the role of daughter, especially when set against her younger, prettier, and more biddable sister, Sharon. Her father, in some of the most expertly, vividly, unsensationally rendered scenes of violence you'll read this side of the boy Cromwell being battered in the opening of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, frequently beats her senseless and senselessly. Her grandparents and the family housekeeper Ruth do what they can to protect and to love her, but it is not enough. Patty's intense need and vulnerability lead her to help hide a German soldier, Anton Reicher, after he escapes from a nearby POW camp. He is a conscript into the army, the son of a historian who spoke out against Hitler until it became too dangerous. He chose acquiescence and life rather than resistance and death. Not a very admirable choice, but a very human one. And his mother was a gardener from England. Anton teases Patty, teaches her, and appreciates her. Everything that brings her hostility and bruises at home, her intellect, her curiosity, her unbiddability, her unfemininity, brings her happiness and growing friendship in the soldier's hideout. She learns that she, just as she stands, just as she is worth something. It ends brutally. But the book, originally rejected by 18 publishers who presumably took fright at the thought of how inflammatory a depiction of a non-evil Nazi befriending a Jewish girl could be, was another landmark one for me. It was my first exposure to the idea that even something as irredeemable as Nazism could contain nuance and complexity. At the very simplest level, I hadn't even known about conscription before. Were you as culpable if you'd been forced to join up as those who did so voluntarily? This alone caused my brain to stutter. And my first step along the road to answering the simple question that arises in every child's mind when they first start learning about Hitler and the Holocaust. How did he happen? Anton's explanation to Patty of how Hitler succeeded is still my go-to reference as I'm reading the headlines about the rise of whichever new or ancient evil is dominating the news cycle that day. His first layer is an undeniable truth such as, the German worker is poor. The second layer is divided equally between flattery and truth. The German worker deserves to be prosperous. The third layer is total fabrication. The Jews and the communists have stolen what is rightfully yours. Evil builds in increments. Your understanding of this basic truth may grow in sophistication and detail over the years, but the earlier and harder you grasp this simple, unchanging, bastard fundamental, the better off you'll be. It is impossible, of course, to say exactly when childhood reading stops and adult reading begins. I was coming up to 16 and my intake was already fairly evenly split between both groups. I was still rereading old favourites like The Family from One End Street and Tom's Midnight Garden, especially when tired, under stress or on holiday. But I was also turning increasingly, and as gleefully and as indiscriminately as I had with all my other reading, to John Irving, Maeve Binchy, Stella Gibbons, Margaret Atwood, Margaret Mitchell, Thackeray, I still haven't touched Dickens, J.G. Ballard, Daniel Defoe, Julian Barnes, Jonathan Swift, Philip Roth, David Lodge, Josephine Tay and Peter Tinniswood. In a year or so's time, I would discover Jane Austen and a whole new level of adoration. Summer of My German Soldier was, I think, one of the last children's books I read for the first time as a child. After that, I would continue to reread old favourites, but my new acquisitions would tend to come from the adult shelves of bookshops and the library. Adult reading, by which I mean reading adult books at a roughly adult age, is different from reading children's books as a child. It's still my favourite thing to do. It is still absolutely necessary to me. I still become fractious and impatient if I don't get my daily fix. but the quality of the experience is different. I do not get absorbed as easily or as fully. I'm more pernickety. Where once any book would have done, I now frequently have to try a few to find one that suits. The joy once guaranteed by simply opening a cover is now more elusive. As an adult, your tastes and or prejudices are more developed and particular, your time is more precious, and your critical faculties are harder to switch off. As an adult, worries are greater and it takes a more powerful page to be able to banish them for the duration. Perhaps you appreciate it all the more when it comes, but I miss the days of effortless immersion and the glorious certainty of pleasure. Even today, my greatest chance of recapturing those heady days comes with sitting down with a children's or YA book. The ones that were around when I was young but which I somehow missed, like Dodie Smith's I Capture the Castle, or the books that followed on from Joan Aitken's The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, have all recreated those early joys despite my late discovery. The Wolves of Willoughby Chase was the story of two cousins, Bonnie and Sylvia, who are turned out of Bonnie's home by the wicked Aunt Slycarp and sent to a viciously cruel orphanage, from which they eventually escape with the aid of a loyal servant and the forest-dwelling Simon, travel to London to find the family lawyer and ensure that justice is done. I never realised, reading it as a child, that this book is just the first in the Wolves Chronicles, Aitken's series of books set in an alternative version of England during the reign of King James III. Most of the rest, which I discovered and devoured in virtually a single sitting about 10 years ago, centre around a vivid, sprightly girl called Dido Twite. The dozen volumes are full of tiny, wondrous details, highly coloured characters, and a sense of imagination perpetually fermenting, dark and joyous by turns. Taken individually and together, they are fine-grained and sweeping epics, almost overwhelming to the senses, but not quite. The perfect preparation, in fact, for Dickens. I blame my ongoing inability to tackle him on the absence of Dido in the formative stages of my biblio life. And of the children's books written long after I reached my majority, well, Pile-Driving Power of Susan Collins' The Hunger Games trilogy or Michael Grant's Gone series will keep you up all night at any age. The delicate tracery of a Frances Harding story will make you hold your breath until the end, lest you disturb the perfect balance of it all. You cannot help but start pressing copies of Patrick Ness's thrilling, heartbreaking, altogether extraordinary Chaos Walking trilogy on everyone you know as soon as you finished it. Meg Rossoff makes you wish she'd been writing for the last 40 years instead of just 14. Everything Melvin Burgess writes crackles with genius, and I spend long hours wondering whether I wish J.K. Rowling had been around when I was young, or whether I'm more grateful to have her now so that Harry Potter can catapult me back and let me read in that headlong, careless rush once more whenever I'm most in need. When I look back, I come out in a cold sweat of relief at all the lucky breaks being a bookworm gives you. Beyond the pure and simple joy it brings, a love of reading grants you an easy life at school. It pleases teachers, who also assume you are clever, I was not, and hard-working, I was, but only because giving in to my natural laziness would have earned me a solid beating at home. It gives you a facility with language, which means all essay-based exams halve in complexity, and later makes covering letters and job applications a great deal more persuasive than they should be, and altogether eases your passage through life far more than any lucky break should. Once you're out of the education system, things even up a bit. The genuinely clever people get the promotions and the money, which is as it should be, and sometimes they will buy you a bottle of nice wine if you help them with their applications and covering letters. We bookworms don't mind, because we only need enough money for books, and promotion would mean longer working hours and less time to read. As I've got older, I've occasionally questioned whether it's possible to take the bookworm thing too far. People say that life's the thing, but I prefer reading. Yes, I've thought in my weaker moments, but you really do need to live some life, don't you? But then I come back to myself and think, no. No, I don't. I have lived so many lives through books, gone to so many places, so many eras, looked through so many different eyes, considered so many different points of view. The fact that I haven't had time to do much myself seems but a small price to pay. I live my life quite as fully as I want, thank you. Books have not isolated me. They've connected me. What non-bookworms get by meeting actual people, we get from reading. C.S. Lewis believed in reading as a spiritual consolation, or at least the best substitute for it. And whatever depredations time, the outside world, and adulthood have wrought, the cruelest of these being that the Little House on the Prairie books now read like prepper manuals for the coming apocalypse instead of charming nostalgic tales of days gone by, it is still mine. Books remain what they have been to me since that first awful awareness dawns that I was an individual, separate from everyone else, and, until and unless you come to know better, alone. They have been an endless comfort. Books connect you to others. It sounds trite, but it's true. You are kept company by characters, by a story, a and by the consciousness held literally in the hand seemingly entire that wrote the book. They all speak to you now across time and space, a commonality of minds, a sharing of experience, a proffering of thoughts and philosophies effortlessly spanning dimensions that would otherwise defeat all such efforts. They are insurmountable proof that the bundle of flaws, fancies, idiocies, instincts, anxieties and aptitudes that is you is neither unique nor alone. A man in Brooklyn can think up a story about a boy riding through a purple toll booth. Purple toll booth, for heaven's sake. And 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, and counting, it can delight and boggle the mind of an 8-year-old in Catford, a 10-year-old in Canberra, or anyone at any point in between. You can share the adventures of a large family in Otwell, or a tiny one under the floorboards, just by knowing how 26 letters variously combine and which way up to hold a book. A boy and a garden that exists only on the page can intimate, as long as that page endures, that all of humanity yearns for the past, needs to know where it comes from in order to know where it's going. If that doesn't strike you as a near-divine miracle, nothing will. I do have, in case you were wondering or worrying, some real flesh-and-blood friends too. We don't meet very often, and when we do, we mainly talk about books we have read or are thinking of reading, but that's exactly how we like it. If you're a parent of a bookworm without being one yourself, first of all, may I say, better that than the other way around. I have serried ranks of books waiting for my son, untold joys patiently biding their time on the bookshelves all round the house, but he's nearly 6 at the time of writing and is showing no signs of following in the footsteps of his 2 bookworm parents. I literally don't know what to do with him. By this age, I didn't need parenting, just feeding and rotating every few hours on the sofa to prevent pressure sores. I'm entirely adrift. Please send help. Second of all, I can see that bookworm offspring can be a bit of a worry. We are rare and we are weird, and no parent wants that. We want our children to have the safety of the crowd. But, and let this free you, there is nothing you can do to change us, any more than I can force my son to be like me. Really, don't try. We are so, so happy in our own way. Just be glad we're not into something actively harmful like smoking or noisy like almost everything else a child cares to do. Be glad of all the benefits it will bring rather than lamenting all the fresh air avoided, the friendships not made, the parties not attended, the exercise not taken, the body of rewarding and potentially lucrative activities, hobbies and skills not developed. Leave us be. We're fine. More than fine. Reading's our thing. This has been an Audible Studios production of Bookworm, a memoir of childhood reading, written by Lucy Mangan, read by Lucy Mangan. Copyright by Lucy Mangan, 2018. Production copyright 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.